Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
And Shabbat Shalom, Juba Mubarak, TGIF, happy Friday. It is a beautiful Friday. What is today? The 15th, I think it is. Yeah, it's the 15th of August. And a lot going on in the world, but of course it being Friday, the first hour of our program. But by the way, in the second hour, we're going to get Dr. Ravi Batra on here, the economics professor from Southern Methodist University and author of Greenspan's Fraud. And we're going to have a conversation with Ravi. We'll bring you in on the conversation about what's going on with the economy. And then in our third hour, Dorothy Fadiman and Ian Sancho are going to come on. They're filmmakers. They've put together a movie about stealing the vote in 2008 with some of the problems that they're seeing already in advance with the Republican Party prepositioning themselves as they did in Florida and Ohio and others. But, of course, it being our first hour, And we'll get into a conversation as the show goes on. I want to share with you what Pravda is talking about with regard to Georgia, things we've been talking about in the last few days here on the program. But to be in the first hour, it is Brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders, I think of him as America's senator. He's neither neither a Republican nor a Democrat, an independent in the United States Senate. And his website, sanders.senate.gov, the senator who so ably represents the great state of Vermont, former residents of mine as well. And Bernie, welcome to the show.
Great to be with you, Tom.
Great to have you. Political theater. I am seeing John Boehner and all these other guys out there grabbing the spotlight, grabbing the headlines. The topic of discussion, even though they are supposedly out of power, is what the Republicans want to be the topic of discussion.
Well, as you know, I mean, you're absolutely right. And, you know, Tom, you know what a shell game is? You know, these guys in big cities who hustle people and they say,
three-card
keep
Monty.
Your eye on the shell, and if you get know where that P is, you're going to win.
Yeah.
And the whole trick of the shell game is to distract your attention. That's what it is. And essentially, that's what Republican theater is. So let's look at reality versus what the Republicans are doing. We right now are living through the last few months of the worst administration in certainly the modern history of America, and some historians believe in the history of our country. The middle class is collapsing. Since Bush has been president, 5 million more Americans have slipped out of the middle class and into poverty. All over America, working people are flocking to emergency food shelves in order to feed their families. Working people can't afford $3.90 for a gallon of gas. 8 million people have lost their health insurance. We have a huge national debt, which is now closing in on $10 trillion. That's reality. Middle class collapsing. Poverty is increasing. Meanwhile, our friends at the Republican Party, who have fought for huge tax breaks for the wealthiest people in this country, who have stood with the insurance companies, who have raised rates, made huge profits while people are paying more and more for their health insurance or, in fact, can't afford health insurance. Suddenly, 3 months before an election, isn't it just amazing how the Republicans are really standing up and they are fighting for ordinary people who are paying these outrageously high gas and oil prices? You just can't stop these guys and their devotion to the American middle class and working class. Now, what they forget to tell us, is that year after year, they have been major recipients of campaign donations from the oil companies. In fact, John McCain has gotten more money from the oil industry than any other candidate that I know of. And what they have done is resisted our efforts not only to have a windfall profits tax on the oil companies, but to do away with the tax breaks the $17 billion in tax breaks they gave the oil companies so that we can adequately fund sustainable energy. They forgot to tell us that. In Congress right now, some of us are trying to end the ability of Wall Street and hedge fund operators to speculate on energy futures, which have driven oil prices up. They're standing with Wall Street against that. And their argument is what we need to do. We need to do is to drill in the continental outer shelf. And if we do that, my God, just miraculously, probably in a few hours, maybe a few minutes, the price of your energy is going to go way down. Well, this is total and absolute nonsense. The Bush administration's Energy Department has told us already that there will be insignificant decreases over 10 or 20 years. So this has nothing to do with driving down the price of oil today. Second of all, we're looking at a situation right now which is on the front pages of the papers all over this country, dealing with the problems in Russia and Georgia. I am nervous about Putin. I am nervous about Russian leadership. But what we seem to have forgotten in the last couple of weeks is, gee, who started the military conflict a couple of weeks ago?
Right. It was Georgia invading the capital of South Ossetia of Skvin Valley.
well known town.
And
so here you have Georgia launching an invasion at the beginning of the Olympics.
Mm-hmm.
And then it turns out, we don't know what this means, but it's that a fellow named Randy Schuneman.
Yeah.
Has been on the payroll of Georgia, receiving substantial sums of money. And, well, there we have it. Coincidentally, he is one of McCain's key foreign policy advisors. Now, the point here is, from a campaign perspective, what you have right now is McCain trying to bring back the Cold War again. And he's going to be tough on Russia. We're going to be spending more money on the military. Halliburton and the General Dynamics and all of the big defense contractors are just salivating. We only spend $515 billion a year now on the military, but if we can get it into a good, long Cold War again with Russia, that means we can spend even more money. We can cut back on education. We can cut back on healthcare. We can cut back on rebuilding our infrastructure. It is, and from a political perspective, the theater is that John McCain is going to be tough on the Russians.
Right. Now, Obama had him beat on Iraq, and Obama had him beat on the economy, so they just came up with something altogether. You know, this is from the Times online, and this is the Times of London, which, of course, is owned by Rupert Murdoch. But Charles Bremner in Moscow reporting, he says, Russians were told over breakfast yesterday. This was published yesterday, so it would have been on Wednesday. Russians were told over breakfast yesterday that what really happened in Georgia. The conflict in South Ossetia was part of a plot by Dick Cheney, the vice president, to stop Barack Obama being elected president of the United States. The line came in the main news of Vesti FM, a state-run radio station, or state radio station, that has reverted to the old habits of Soviet years in which a sinister American hand is held to lie behind every conflict. The Obama angle is getting wide play across Russia. It was aired on Wednesday by Sergei Markov, a senior political scientist who is close to Vladimir Putin. And then they go on to say, this is an actual quote from one of the Russian commentators. George Bush's administration is promoting interests of candidate John McCain, said Dr. Markov. Defeated by Barack Obama on all fronts, McCain has one last card to play yet, the creation of a virtual Cold War with Russia. Bush himself did not want a war in South Ossetia, but his Republican Party did not leave him any choice.
Well, I don't, you know.
You know, keep in mind, this is Russian propaganda.
Right, this is Russian propaganda. But all that I know is that Randy Schuneman was a past director of the Project for a New American Century.
Yeah, and the Free Iraq League or Free
but
Iraq.
These are the guys. Here's the issue now.
Yeah.
These are the guys who got us into the war in Iraq.
Yeah.
And apparently that war, at a cost of $1 to $3 trillion, tens of thousands of casualties, was not enough. And maybe they're back again. But I would hope very much that the American people are not this time going to fall for the same line that we did last time. Clearly, we have concerns. I have concerns about Russian leadership. I have concerns about the growing lack of democracy in Russia. But the last thing in the world that we need is a new Cold War with Russia. We have dealt with these folks for the last 17 years since the decline of the Soviet Union. We can continue to deal with them. I just don't want to see, once again, us sacrificing the needs of the middle class and working families of this country for an increased military buildup and, God forbid, another war. So what I think people should take a look at is, in terms of the remaining 3 months of this campaign, is how the Republicans are doing everything they can to deflect attention from the fact that our economy is collapsing, our healthcare system is disintegrating, and they're going to try to deflect attention to other issues that work for them politically.
Absolutely. 16 minutes past the hour. It's Brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders, sanders.senate.gov, his website. With us taking now your calls at 866-303-2270. It's the Tom Hartman Program here on Air America Radio. TomHartman.com if you want to drop into our live chat room. AirAmerica.com for our free live video stream.
Visit HartmanRadio.com for live streaming video of the Tom Hartman Program.
States, we're the ones who need it worse. Let the rest of the world help us for change, and let's rebuild America first. Our highways and bridges are falling apart. Who's blessed? Who has been cursed? There's things to be done all over the world, but let's rebuild America first.
Yeah, Merle Haggard. Let's rebuild America first. Welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour on the True People's Radio, the Tom Hartman Program. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. Bernie, anything you wanted to wrap up, or should we go right to the phones here?
We're ready to go.
All righty. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Beth in Minneapolis, Minnesota. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Thank you so much, Tom. Good morning, both of you. And Senator Sanders, I really appreciate the opportunity to ask you a question this morning.
Thank you, Beth.
I didn't call for this subject, but I wanted to mention Thomas Frank has a new book out that talks about the Republican Party, and he's the one who wrote What's the Matter with Kansas?
Right.
This new book analyzes why the Republican Party always rules to destruction.
He's going to be on our show on Thursday, by the way, Beth.
Oh, wonderful. Well, yeah, this is a real interesting insight into why this is all happening. But aside from that, Senator Sanders, has anything new happened in the way of school loans? My son is putting himself through college, and he really wants to go to dental school.
Glad that he wants to go to dental school, because that has been a bit of an obsession of mine, because in Vermont and all over this country, millions and millions of low and moderate income people are finding it almost impossible to find a dentist and get dental care at a reasonable price. So what we are trying to do and what we have done, let me tell you what we have done. What we have done is, in the Higher Ed Reconciliation Act last year, what we have said is that for those people who work in nonprofit institutions or organizations, whether it's a federally qualified health center or a hospital, nonprofit hospital, et cetera, their debt will be forgiven if they work for 10 years in a nonprofit. So if your son were to graduate with a debt and he worked in a nonprofit for 10 years, the remaining debt would be forgiven, and that would be after a cap on his loans over the first 10 years. That is not enough. We've got to do more. What we are also trying to do with some success is get more money into what we call the National Health Service Corps, which provides scholarships and debt forgiveness for people who want to be doctors or nurses or dentists and serve in underserved areas. So, Beth, you're talking about a very important issue to me. We need more dentists. We need more doctors. We need to make sure that we have a strong primary health care system, and it is an issue we are perhaps making a little bit of progress on.
Great. Margaret in Asheville, North Carolina, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Good morning, gentlemen, and thank you very much both, to both of you, the work that you both do. I am very outraged. I've been outraged over the last 7 years. But this latest outrage of two-thirds of the U.S. corporations not paying taxes, and Senator McCain wants to actually increase that base of non-taxed corporations. What happens, Mr. Senator Sanders, when America no longer has a middle class and we're all scraping in the barrel, and driving on dirt roads? What happens when that tax base of the 80% of us who are making $75,000 or less a year are gone? And how do we pay all these bills?
Well, I'll tell you how, Margaret. First of all, in my view, you've asked a profound question. It is a question that we don't ask often enough. And the answer is that people like John McCain and his corporate backers could care less about the American middle class. And one of the manifestations of unfettered free trade that you see time and time again, and if you read the press, these guys are pretty honest about it. Large corporations say, in fact, one of McCain's advisors has said, Americans are not entitled to these jobs. If we can find, in so many words now, I'm paraphrasing, if we can find people in China who are going to work for 40 cents an hour, why do we have to employ people in this country, provide health care, environmental protection, maybe deal with unions? We don't have to do that. We're in a global economy. You know what that means if you're a large corporation? You're not an American company. The fate of the American middle class is irrelevant to you. If I'm a CEO and I'm pulling in 10, 20, 30 million a year, and I'm making 400 times more than my workers, why do I have to worry about the middle class of this country? We had the obscene example, and this, I think, did not get enough attention, is Vice President of the United States Cheney's former company, Halliburton, is now stationed in where in the Middle East, Tom?
Abu Dhabi, I think, or Dubai.
In Dubai.
They moved to, yeah.
So, I mean, to answer Margaret's question, if the vice president's own company moves to Dubai to avoid taxes or other obligations, that tells you everything that you need to know.
That country also only requires corporations to keep business records for 12 months.
Right, and we know, I mean, we have seen examples of huge numbers of companies running offshore to the Cayman Islands or Bermuda in order to avoid taxes. And then they have the nerve, McCain and his friends have the nerve to stand in front of the American flag and talk about patriotism. Well, that is the furthest thing from the reality of what their policies are about.
Yeah, very well said. 27 minutes past the hour. Senator Bernie Sanders with us, taking your calls at 866-303-2270. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour. Sanders.Senate.gov is Bernie's website. You can drop by our live chat room over at TomHartmann.com. And, of course, you can find our live streaming video at AirAmerica.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program. Call 866-303-2270.
Would flow evermore. Now with little warning, the cash flow has stopped. I'm feeling reamed out to the core. In mortgages and weapons, pork bellies and land, believe me, I made quite a killing. Now I need some help from my friend Uncle Sam. Brother, can you spare a couple billion?
Oh, the lament of the Wall Street brokers. 34 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartmann radio program, Viagra for your brain. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. Our Brunch with Bernie hour. Sanders.Senate.gov, his website. Our phone number, 866-303-2270. Our telephone number. And David in San Antonio, Texas. You're on with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hey, how you doing, Tom? Mr. Sanders, this is my question. First of all, I want to say, why is it any of our business what type of democracy or a lack of democracy that people are running in their countries. And I figure, you know, from history, from history's perspective, this is exactly the type of mentality that has gotten this country in the financial bind, the world hate and dislike of people in this country and what we represent. And I remember it was a president, I can't remember which Roosevelt it said, which said it, but they said if we just mind our own business and take care of the U.S., that this country will be the wealthiest country in the world.
I think that was something like George Washington.
That was, yeah, it was George Washington's farewell address. Well said, David.
Well, David makes a good point. And let's be clear. If anybody does not understand that a lot of the policies of the United States government are directed by big money interests who make huge profits out of those policies, then you really don't know what is going on. And I just want people to understand this. When we talk about the war in Iraq and how we were misled into the war in Iraq and all of the tragedy that has happened since in terms of loss of life and dislocation in Iraq and refugees in Iraq, et cetera, remember something else, that there are a number of contractors who have made out like bandits and, in fact, who are bandits, who have lied. I've been on hearings listening to these people who have ripped off the American taxpayer, ripped off the soldiers who are putting their lives on the line. So to answer David's question, just I want David to put it in another perspective. If you're part of the military-industrial complex, if you stand to make billions and billions of dollars by building more weaponry and bombs and planes and so forth and so on in a never-ending Cold War, this time against Russia, that's a pretty good thing. And that's essentially, I think, what we're looking at. Right now, we have increased hunger in America. We have the highest rate of childhood poverty in America. We got a call a few moments ago from a woman whose son can't afford to go to dental school. Millions of families can't afford to send the kids to college. We're cutting back. Until recently, at least, we are not providing the kind of financial assistance our families need. So David's point is maybe we might want to address the real economic problems facing this country, rebuilding our infrastructure, moving us away from fossil fuel to sustainable energy. Maybe that makes more sense than spending huge amounts of money on the military and getting involved in entanglements all over the world. And I would agree with David on that.
Yeah, you're sounding like Dwight Eisenhower, too.
Well, let me tell you something. There's a lot to be learned from Dwight David Eisenhower, who alone stood up at his time when he was president to the Republicans, stood up to the Democrats, and said, I would rather have a balanced budget than more money on military spending. And please don't tell me about the needs of the military, because I was the guy who was the leading general in World War II. Yeah, we need a few more Dwight David Eisenhowers around today, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, if you want to take 1 minute, we can hear his speech about the cost of a bomber. It's essentially.
Let's hear that.
If you have that, Tom, that's great. Here it is. This is Dwight Eisenhower speaking before the American Society of Newspaper Editors in Washington, D.C., April 16, 1953.
Every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired signifies, in the final sense, a theft from those who hunger and are not fed. Those who are cold and are not clothed. This world in arms is not spending money alone. It is spending the sweat of its laborers, the genius of its scientists, the hopes of its children. The cost of one modern heavy bomber is this: a modern brick school in more than 30 cities. It is two electric power plants, each serving a town of 60,000 population. It is two fine, fully equipped hospitals. It is some 50 miles of concrete pavement. We pay for a single fighter plane with a 500,000 bushels of wheat. We pay for a single destroyer with new homes that could have housed more than 8,000 people. This is not a way of life at all. In any true sense. Under the cloud of threatening war, it is humanity hanging from a cross of iron.
This is referred to as his cross of iron speech.
Now, you know what? That is, and let's remember, this was what year? 19?
This is 53. His second year as president of the United States, or its
you know
third
what?
Year.
Have you heard any presidential candidates recently talk as boldly as this guy who is a moderate Republican?
And a highly decorated general from World War II.
Highly decorated. He was, you know, the leader of the European effort.
Yeah.
Five-star general. And what Eisenhower said in 1953 is truer today. Remember, $515 billion on the military, not counting Iraq and Afghanistan. Meanwhile, I fought just a month ago to get a bill onto the floor. We lost the vote because the Republicans filibustered. We couldn't get 60 votes to increase the home energy assistance program to make sure that people don't go cold or freeze to death this winter or die of heat exhaustion in the southern part of this country. We needed $2.5 billion. Do you know what $2.5 billion is? That is 1 week in Iraq. That's what it is. And you can use that analogy for education. You could use it for health care. For $8 billion, we can provide primary health care to every man, woman, and child in this country by expanding community health centers, low-cost prescription drugs, dental care. That is 1 month in Iraq. That's the trade-off. What Eisenhower said was incredibly prescient, and it is even truer today.
Yeah, amen. Chuck, in San Jose, California, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hi, Tom?
Yes, sir.
Hi. Oh, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I may be ahead of it a little bit, but I read recently in a weekly periodical that Wall Street is pushing and the federal government is actually in line, maybe in line with allowing Wall Street to start managing these pension plans for buying them, I guess it is. I don't understand the whole thing, but we've had, what is it, about 150 years of Wall Street stress. And why are, you know, after all that's going on and where we are, why would we allow Wall Street to start,
you're talking,
you know,
about taking over federal pension plans, federal employees?
Well, it's not the federal, it's from companies. It might be the pension guarantee part of it too, but they were saying in the book, in the magazine, that buying pension plans from these companies that want to get out of them.
Well,
not good.
The
not
pension,
good.
I worked on pensions for a little while, and one of the particular disasters of many of the Bush administration is since he has been president, well over 3 million Americans have lost their pensions, and I'm sure there are people who are listening to the show today who worked for decades at a company, were promised a pension, and then the company said, oh, sorry, we changed our mind, too bad. Meanwhile, they give these great golden parachutes to the CEOs of these companies. Bottom line in terms of pensions is that we are rapidly losing the concept of defined pension benefits, where people know what they could expect, and we're moving more and more to essentially where workers are being forced to save for themselves for retirement age, when in fact they have very limited income to do that, because in many cases the wages that they're earning today are just not sufficient for today, let alone to put aside for retirement. So Wall Street getting involved in that, you know, nothing should surprise us. But clearly the key debate that we're going to be seeing in this campaign is whether or not we do what Bush had wanted to do unsuccessfully. He did not succeed, thank God, and that is move toward the privatization of Social Security. Right. And rather having the government making sure that you know what you're getting and you will get it, move toward these private insurance accounts where, you know, the stock market goes down, well, tough luck for you.
Yeah, it sounds like he's talking about basically they're turning a pension plan into simply another security that can be packaged and sold, or another
right.
product. It's downright frightening. David in Asheville, North Carolina. We've got a minute before the break here, David.
All right, very, very quickly. When you were talking originally about the fact that offshore drilling won't be changing the price of gas in the hours or minutes the Republicans are claiming it will.
Yeah.
Weren't you being a bit naive there? I mean, it's not that far-fetched to assume that the oil companies, as Tom has been saying for several weeks, are artificially holding oil off the market to raise the price, and therefore their profit per gallon, which is exactly what's happened, and to reduce public resistance to offshore drilling, which recent polls have shown is also what's happened. If they have no problem doing that to satisfy their agenda, why wouldn't they flood the market the minute they're given the go-ahead for offshore drilling, and which would drop the price down, and thereby make the Republicans, the John Boehner charade going on in the Congress, make them look like heroes and therefore reelectable.
Well, I mean, anything
would be a short-term drop.
All that I could tell you is the amount of oil that we get in 10 or 20 years will not have any significant impact on pricing. That's what the Bush administration itself says.
But if they tried that, it would be a short-term thing. It would probably just be until the election. That's an interesting
theory. To lower prices before the election.
Yeah, it's an interesting theory. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. Brunch with Bernie, 45 minutes past the hour. Stick around.
An historic time for America. Live, on-site coverage of the Democratic National Convention on Air America and AirAmerica.com. Our time is now.
Welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour, the Tom Hartman radio program defending America from the weapons of mass deception. Our Brunch with Bernie hour, Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls. Dan in Michigan, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Senator Sanders. It's a pleasure to talk to you. You were talking about undue corporate influence in this country, especially in the defense industry.
Yes.
And it's I think, spread beyond America, obviously, and into other countries. And when the Soviet Union broke up, I think that was taken as an opportunity for a lot of these multinational corporations to take on these smaller countries as client states.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wanted to point something out, and I don't know if you're aware of this or not, and I'd like to make you aware of it if you weren't. On the Azerbaijan Chamber of Commerce, there is a number of former or actually current Project for New American Century members that sit on the board of the Azerbaijan Chamber of Commerce, among which Richard Cheney was a former member, along with Richard Armitage. Your colleagues John Sununu and Sam Brownback currently sit on it. Richard Pearl, Henry Kissinger, James Baker III, James Baker IV. I mean, it reads just like the same people who sold us the Iraq War, and I was just wondering if you were aware of that, and if not, I wanted to make
it. Well, thank you very much, Dan. I was not aware of that particular instance, but I certainly am aware, as you indicated, that the American military-industrial complex has certainly become globalized. There is a huge amount of money to be made in terms of supplying weapons and defense equipment to countries all over the world.
Yeah. There, this is very interesting. Just this breaking headline from Tbilisi, Georgia, article by Matthew Lee, I think it's the Associated Press. A reluctant Georgian president, Mikhail Saakashvili, said Friday he signed a ceasefire agreement with Russia and declared in the presence of the chief U.S. diplomat that the West, in capitals, behaved in ways that invited the invasion.
Well, you know, what is amazing to me, we really aren't in an Orwellian situation here. It was a couple of, and again, I'm not here defending Russia because I think Russia overreacted. There was a lot of brutality there. But 2 weeks ago, it was Georgia who started this war. They launched an invasion. And that we can forget about it in just 2 weeks and rewrite history in 2 weeks is, I think, a pretty frightening development.
Yeah. Apropos of that, is it Gurmit in Seattle, Washington? You have a question for Senator Sanders?
Yes. Good morning, Senator. And
good morning.
Thank you for taking the call. I'm from India, and I have been seeing a sharp decline in political and economic situation in U.S. for the last 4 or 5 years due to disastrous policies of current administration. So my question is this: how is that a good proportion of U.S. population is still so blind to the dirty tricks of the ruling party that are so clear to the rest of the world?
Well, you asked the you asked the question that perhaps we began discussing at the beginning of this program, and that is, you're quite right that the Bush administration has been an absolute disaster for the middle class and working families of this country. And I could tick off all of the indices, but I think most people know it, whether it's decline in wages, loss of decent paying jobs, loss of health care, and on it goes. And the Republican leadership, which works significantly for the wealthiest people in this country, really doesn't stay up nights worrying about the middle class or working families. That's not what their concern is. But what they are, in fact, very good at is what we call, I think what Tom calls, is political theater. They know how to frame issues and mislead people. So suddenly, for example, you have a Republican Party, which has worked hand in glove with the large oil companies who have enjoyed record-breaking profits, making some $600 billion since Bush has been president. Suddenly, they are very, very concerned about the high price of gas and oil. Well, that is theater. They work very closely with the military-industrial complex, who wants to make more money by prolonging the Cold War and so forth and so on. So to answer your very good question, what you have are people who are very good at political theater. You have a media largely owned by multinational corporations who helps propagate that perspective.
Yeah, indeed. Nora in Minneapolis, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. Before my question, I wanted to give a quick announcement. Somebody just put up two really great graffiti here in Minneapolis, and they're going to pay $5,000 to remove them before the Republican convention. One says, "Get out, fascists," spelled with PH, and the other one is "Greed over people," and they're going to pay $5,000 to get rid of them. But my question is about, you know, I heard Ralph Nader this weekend talking about an issue that's extremely disturbing, and that is the law against not marijuana itself, but industrial hemp has it listed under controlled substances as if industrial hemp is a bad drug. And there was two petitions that were signed and presented, one to the Clinton administration and one to the Bush administration, and both of them were denied, and it makes Democrats look so extremely lame. I'm wondering, maybe that's why you left the Democratic Party, right?
Well, I was never a member of the Democratic Party. I'm an independent who caucuses with the Democrats, and I'm proud of being an independent. I think the hemp issue is an interesting issue. I know that the Vermont state legislature dealt with it a couple of years ago, and there's an argument to be made that hemp is a product that could be very useful in a number of ways. Obviously, the other point is that people are worried about hemp being associated with marijuana, et cetera, et cetera. But I think it is an issue that we should explore.
Yeah, Canada seems to be doing very well with it. I mean,
are they with hemp?
They're growing it like crazy up there.
I think that is an issue we should take a very hard look at.
Yeah, you can buy hemp milk here in the United States, hemp products, all kinds of stuff. Senator Bernie Sanders. Bernie, thanks so much for being with us today.
Good to be with you, Tom.
It is always marvelous having you on the program, and we're so grateful all these years that you've been on taking our listeners' calls.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Bernie. Sanders.Senate.gov is Bernie's website. Check it out. 57 minutes past the hour. Robbie Botcher is going to drop by in the next hour and talk to us about what's going on with the economy. Has the asset bubble burst? Stick around.
This is Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back to our program. Just a quick heads up on some of the stuff coming up here. The Democratic and Republican conventions just a couple of weeks down the road. Monday, August 25th, from 2 to 3 p.m. Now, this would be in Denver. Denver time. Air America's Tom Hartman, that's me, debates conservative political commentator Dennis Prager about the key issues facing the candidates in the 2008 presidential election. Also on Monday from 3:30 to 4:30, Air America Media and the Progressive Book Club are going to host the contest, Progressives versus Conservatives. And it'll be me, Paul Krugman, Arianna Huffington, John Podesta, David Sirota, sponsored by the Green Mountain Coffee Roasters in the Big Tent. That's at the corner of 15th and Wincoop Streets. And tickets to be announced. Tuesday, August 26th at 6 p.m. in Denver, I'll be giving a talk and signing books at Borders Books in Lone Tree at the Park Meadows Mall. Drop by there, and there should be information over at am760.net as well on that, plus, of course, at tomhartman.com on our calendar. And in the Republican Convention on September 1st, on Monday, SEIU's Take Back Labor Day Festival in Harriet Island. Join me and Minneapolis's hip-hop acts Atmosphere and Lupe Fiasco, actor-musician Mos Def, and British rocker Billy Bragg. And we're all joining the lineup of the SEIU, Service Employees International Union, Take Back Labor Day Festival at the foot of the Republican National Convention. Festival will run from noon to 7 p.m., and will feature musicians Stevie Earle, Allison Moore, and Tom Morello, and speakers will include Andy Stern, president of SEIU, Change to Windshare, Anna Berger, and me. And you can purchase tickets at Ticketmaster.com on that. And then Tuesday, September 2nd, The Voice of Minnesota invites you to a party for change. It's AM950 putting this thing on, and it'll be Bill Press, Stephanie Miller, Jim Ward, Chris Lavoie, Ed Schultz, John Elliott, and me. And Bill Press and I will be doing book signings. Doors open at 5:30, party until 9:30 at Black Bear Crossing. Boy, a lot of stuff coming up, so just to give you a heads up on that. Robbie Batra is on the line with us. Robbie Batra, a friend of the show for many, many years, economics professor at Southern Methodist University in Texas, internationally best-selling author of Greenspan's Fraud and the New Golden Age. His website, Robbie Batra, RAVIBATRA.com. And Robbie, welcome to the show.
Thanks a lot, Tom. Thank you.
Ravi, it looks to me like, tell me if you think I'm nuts on this, and I say this speaking as somebody who has seen the value of my own savings decline by about 20% over the last month or two because so much of it was invested in commodities, particularly gold, but it looks to me like what we saw with gold and oil in particular, but a whole lot of other commodities as well, was a classic bubble, a speculative bubble that, much like the housing bubble a couple of years earlier, and then the stock market bubble before that, and the dot-com bubble before that, we've got this bubble economy that has burst or is bursting and might have a long way down to go. I remember, back in the 70s, I think it was, reading Howard Ruff's newsletter and getting all wired, and I bought gold at 600 in the 70s. I mean, it wasn't a good idea. What's your take on what's going on with the markets and particularly with commodities?
Well, that's what I've been saying for the last 3-4 years. You hear from the administration, all of the economists, they keep talking about oil demand from India and China. And I was saying there are two other things which are responsible. There is not much demand pressure because supply is rising just as fast as demand, although nobody talks about rising supply from Russia, Saudi Arabia, Canada, and so on. But supply is rising just as fast as demand, so there should be no demand pressure on oil. All this is the result of, first of all, tremendous monopoly power that the oil companies have, and as a result of that monopoly power, a lot of speculation is occurring and manipulating the price of oil. See, speculation can succeed only when there is monopoly power, not when there is a lot of competition. Mm-hmm. You can see there's not much speculation in natural gas, for instance. That's also a commodity, but there's a lot more, and that's also a commodity dealing with energy. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of speculation in oil, and the reason it succeeds is that there is this monopoly power among oil companies.
Right.
So as a result, now all those theories about oil demand from India and China are defeated. I mean, there is no sudden fall in demand from India and China, is there? So demand from India and China is still there, but oil is falling sharply. Now, that is a typical behavior of the bubbles. They rise fast, and then there's correction before they start rising again. So I don't think this bubble has really ended, because it will end only when there is an end to speculation and the monopoly power of oil companies. But a few months ago, I think about a month ago, the House rejected the bill against the speculation in oil, so that speculation will continue. Oil companies are as monopolistic as ever, so once things settle down a bit and there is some supply disruption, maybe from a hurricane or like Russia and Georgia fighting or something in the Middle East.
War in Iran or something.
Then these oil speculators will use that as an excuse to jack up the price again.
So you think this is a correction, not a bursting bubble, and maybe just a correction that will give the speculators an opportunity to buy back into it?
That's right.
Yeah.
Do you remember that dot-com bubble we had in the late 1990s?
Yeah.
Now, it finally crashed in the year 2000 and 2001, but before it crashed, there were many bursting of the bubbles. At one time in 1999, the NASDAQ market had fallen by 50%.
Mm.
Just imagine, a 50% fall in the NASDAQ index in 1999. Towards the end of the year, it made a comeback, and then, of course, crashed later. So there are bubbles have that nature. They go up fast, then the correction is also strong,
right.
Only to come back unless, as I said, this bubble is going to burst for two or three reasons. One is the end to the speculation in oil. That's not going to happen right now. The other is the monopoly power of oil companies ending. That's not happening now. The third reason could be a very, very serious recession that nobody wants, but that could happen sometime maybe next year. Then the bubble could burst. But right now the bubble, I think, still is intact.
Although we saw the European Union, this front page of today's Financial Times, the first quarter of actual negative growth across the EU.
Yeah, but it's a very small amount.
Yeah, 0.3%. But they're looking at recession. So let me toss another one out at you. The oil companies are hysteric. They're sitting on 10,000 leases to drill, and they basically list these as assets on their balance sheets. It inflates the value of the companies because they can hold these leases forever, unlike the coal companies that have to actually, you know, mine the coal or lose their lease. They want to add even more leases to their balance sheets, which will inflate their stock value. If ExxonMobil, for example, can get drilling privileges up in Anwar, even though it might take a decade for them to actually do the drilling, the minute that they get that right and they can put that lease on their balance sheet, their company's worth an extra couple $1 billion, their stock price goes up, all the executives cash in their stock options, make a fortune, everybody's happy. And the Republicans are pushing like crazy to make this happen, of course, and, you know, doing all this political theater in Washington, D.C., and we had a caller in the last hour who put forward a theory that makes perfect sense to me, that if the Republicans, if Nancy Pelosi goes along with them, which it looks like she probably will, and grants limited drilling both offshore and perhaps even up north, but certainly offshore, limited drilling rights, then the oil companies may just, you know, dump a bunch of inventory over the short term, like between now and the election, drive down the price of oil, drive down the price of gasoline, make the Republicans look like heroes, and get John McCain elected president. What do you think?
That's possible. I mean, these people are very afraid of Barack Obama. There's all sorts of ways in which they can manipulate things. They really certainly don't need more drilling leases because, my information is that they already have 68 million acres of federal property,
That's right.
On which they're not drilling.
Right, including the what used to be called the Naval Petroleum Reserve up in Alaska, which has got billions and billions of barrels of oil in it.
Sitting on that, so what more do they need now?
Right, they just want to increase their balance sheets, I think. We're talking with Ravi Batra. I'd like to pick up on the other side of this break, Ravi, a conversation about the economic plans of the two candidates, and then we'll take some callers, if that's okay.
Okay.
16 minutes past the hour.
Air America makes history. Live broadcasts and continuing coverage from the DNC in Denver on Air America and AirAmerica.com. Our time is now.
Thank you. He was looked on with some shock. Now heaven knows.
21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. We have Dr. Ravi Batra on the line with us. RaviBatra.com, his website. The author of New York Times and internationally best-selling author of a whole pile of books, the most recent ones being The New Golden Age and Greenspan's Fraud, two of my favorites. I think I said Ravi Batra, RaviBatra.com, his website. Professor of Economics at Southern Methodist University. Dr. Batra, let's just revisit very quickly. I think this is an economics lesson that we can't do too often. How it is that the American economy worked and was built so effectively from the 1930s to the 1980s and then began to collapse with the election of Ronald Reagan, and we find ourselves now in this god-awful mess that it looks like at least the early stages of something that might even resemble a depression. Go through the economic basis, the Econ 101 here for us.
Yeah. Before I answer this question in detail, let me give you the full title of this book, The New Golden Age. It's very optimistic title, but then there is a subtitle to it which says, The Coming Revolution Against Political Corruption and Economic Chaos. So what the message of the book is that there is going to be economic chaos in the next, it has already started, in fact, but then it's going to get worse and worse over the next 3-4 years. Then people will be so fed up that they will overthrow the rule of money in society. Yeah, the rule of money in society will be gone. Once that happens, we have a new golden age, a very strong economy, a healthy economy, a very disciplined, improved society.
Right.
So that's the message of this book, The New Golden Age. And I had also predicted in this book that a man like Barack Obama would come to the front and start a revolution against the rule of lobbyists, against the rule of big business, and so on. And I have a feeling that he's going to get elected as the president. But even if he's not, the movement he has started is going to get stronger and stronger.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the economy did very well from 1940 all the way up to 1980. And then what was the secret behind this? The secret is actually very simple. The secret is a matter of supply and demand, which most economists ignore. Although they keep talking about supply and demand, they ignore the factors that affect supply and demand. This is a mantra to them, but they don't want to implement policies that affect demand especially. It's fine with them if you follow policies that encourage, that give subsidies and breaks, tax breaks to the business people to encourage supply, but they don't want to give any help to the demand side of the economy, and that's the trouble with their policy.
And the demand side of the economy is wages.
Well, that's okay. So supply and demand. The main source of demand are wages. Wages are the main source of demand.
So if you want to stimulate an economy, raise wages. Have strong unions, have a higher minimum wage,
exactly.
and that will create demand. And then if you have trade policies that help keep industries within the country, at least, then you're building stuff in your own country. You've got more people working. It's a positive spiral. It's what we had
from the 40s to the 80s. Supply and demand. The wages should be raised when productivity is rising, because productivity
right.
is the main source of supply. So again, productivity is the main source of supply. Wages are the main source of demand. And from 1940 all the way up to 1980, wages were rising as fast as productivity. So supply-demand balance was properly maintained. Everybody was benefiting. The living standard was rising for all without having to go into debt.
Right.
Now,
and then wages with Reagan, when Reagan declared war on working people, starting with his breaking PATCO, wages started to slide, whereas productivity continued to increase. And so this imbalance was created.
Productivity increased faster because of the computer revolution.
Mm-hmm.
And wages, as you said, started to fall. So now it's a supply-demand gap developed. The supply rose very fast. Demand did not. So then Reagan's economists, especially Alan Greenspan, that's where Greenspan's fraud comes in, they came up with this very nice scheme. Let's create more debt in the economy through increased government spending and by bringing down interest rates, because as you bring down interest rates, that lures people into borrowing, and then they spend money. So instead of spending money out of their increased wages, people had to spend money out of their increased borrowing and debt. So ever since Reagan, the supply-demand balance has been maintained through the increase in debt. And that's why by now, even though the economy has remained stable, debt is at its all-time high. But the problem with, first of all, it's not good policy. It doesn't raise anybody's living standard if you're increasing your consumption through debt.
Right.
Secondly, it creates all sorts of imbalances for which we are. I will explain that for the next.
Okay, we'll pick that up and then we'll take some calls from our listeners here. 27 minutes past the hour. Dr. Ravi Batra with us. RaviBatra.com, his website. His most recent books, The New Golden Age and Greenspan's Fraud. Our number, 866-303-2270. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, TomHartman.com, AirAmerica.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman program. Call 866-303-2270.
From the weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you, and Dr. Ravi Batra with us, the professor of economics from Southern Methodist University in Dallas. His books, Greenspan's Fraud and the New Golden Age, the Coming Revolution Against Political Corruption and Economic Chaos. And Dr. Batra, we've got a whole board full of calls. Every single line is slammed right now, so we've got a lot of callers for you. But let's just very quickly and tightly wrap this up. Yeah.
Let me finish the thought. So ever since 1980, we have been creating new demand by increasing debt to match increasing supply coming from rising productivity. But this kind of policy eventually leads to a huge credit crisis. Banks need some kind of good collateral before they can lend. They would lend money. Of course, they became reckless in the past 7 years, and now they're paying for it. But people don't have good collateral anymore now.
Mm-hmm.
Now their home equities are gone. So the policy of creating new debt to support the economy will not work now. Ben Bernanke is doing the same thing as Greenspan was doing. That's why these policies are not working now.
Yeah, and there's only so far. I mean, the American people, the American public by now, by and large, who had a lot of assets in 1980 are largely bankrupt now.
Largely bankrupt. And so there's a very sharp fall in the living standard, although consumption is still high, but that's based on debt. That's
right.
Not wealth. That doesn't make you feel good. It makes you feel really sad, and that's what's happening.
Yeah, okay. Let's take some phone calls here. Steve in New Jersey, you're on with Dr. Ravi Batra. Hey, Steve.
Yes, hello. Hello?
Yeah, you're on the air.
Hello, sir. First-time caller, just getting into the whole serious thing, and I think your show is great. Two questions, really. One kind of macro, one kind of a micro for the professor. I'm kind of curious to take his opinion on it. Talk a lot about national debt and how large it's been, and basically it's almost been doubled by this last administration. I'm kind of curious, is there really effective ways for the government and for consumers to really kind of work this debt down over time, or is it just such a large number that it's almost too big and it's just something that everybody was going to have to deal with politically and economically, just nobody wants to say it? The second question I have is much more basic. Say, for example, an American consumer who wants to go out and buy a new car. Is it better at this point, economically, to buy a GM or a Ford car that is actually assembled in Canada or Mexico and employs
the people from those countries, or is it better to go out and buy a Honda or Toyota, which is a foreign company, but yet employs Americans? And those are two questions I have. Thanks for letting me call, and I'll hang up and listen to your response.
Thanks, Steve.
Okay, about the debt problem. Well, with the right policies, any problem can be tackled, any problem can be solved. Remember, after the Second World War, the United States had incredible amount of debt, defense-related debt, but it was debt.
Mm-hmm. In fact, we were at 100% of GNP for one
year. Exactly, at that time. But with the right policies, as wages kept up with GDP, growth was very strong, we slowly retired that debt. We can do the same thing now if they would allow wages to rise. Remember what the minimum wage was in the 1950s and in 1960s, $9 per hour in terms of today's prices. Today it's barely $6. So that's a huge fall in the living standard of the people. That's why people are borrowing to stay afloat.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing was about the cars. Well, my personal opinion on this is this. I buy a car made in the United States on the U.S. soil because I think all these imports create tremendous amount of pollution because they have to be transported, and all increases the demand for oil, increases pollution. So personally, I've been using Chrysler cars for the last 20 years.
Hmm. Yeah. And Chrysler, of course, is now a German company, which means that the profits are going to Germany. Shouldn't there be some sort of, although the cars are manufactured here in the United States, so we get the jobs, but we don't keep the profit. Isn't there something wrong with the trade policy that encourages that? Given
whatever the government is doing, given the constraints, I would still buy something which is made on the U.S. soil
rather than
which comes from abroad.
Right. I understand. It seems like our trade policies are just a mess.
Trade policy also brings wages down, so it's a bad policy all around.
Right. Okay. Pat in Los Angeles, listening on K-Talk. You're on with Dr. Ravi Batra.
Hey, everybody. I think I have a solution for this crummy economy. I would like to see people, whether it's in economics or in society, think not so lopsidedly in quantities, but think also more balancedly in terms of qualities also, whether it's the quality of a job, the quality of investment, or the quantity in your bank account, the quantity in your wages. By focusing just on one side of the human equation, we totally lose track of what we value, what the qualities we value, whether it's and which is made in America or not made by slaves, that tends to twiddle the productivity measure, as far as I'm concerned, and if we just balance our way of thinking about this economy and not think of it just as a numbers
science, but this is sort of a variation on Bobby Kennedy's speech, and Pat didn't have a question but a speech, but it does raise an interesting question, Dr. Batra, which is, to what extent is the increase in perceived productivity in the United States the result of imports from countries where labor is so radically cheaper than in the United States that it appears that there's an increase in productivity here?
Well, whatever the reason, the fact still remains that productivity is rising. See, in the end, whether it's the foreign workers producing our product, like outsourcing is rising sharply, and a lot of foreign workers are producing U.S. GDP because of that outsourcing.
Mm-hmm.
But the end result is an increase in supply, whatever the reason.
Right.
And that has to be matched by increase in demand. Otherwise, there are layoffs.
Right. Which means increasing it by matching it by an increase in wages.
Exactly. And so now you see, for the past 6-7 months, people are being laid off. 500,000 have been already laid off, and there is no end in sight.
Yeah. Len in New York City, you're on the air with Dr. Ravi Batra.
Hi. Good to speak to you. I guess my question is, you know, the commodities around, gold, silver, everything have dropped, some think through support levels, which, raise a question of worldwide, demand, meaning that there's possibly a worldwide slowdown in the offing. And one particular economist I listen to thinks this entire problem we have is really all due to, or primarily due to, U.S. credit. In other words, people might look at Europe right now and say, oh, they're slowing down because the United States demand is slowing down. But really the problem is that they're slowing down because the value of our debt has become poor, and that means the credit crunches. So
right.
It's a
reduction of liquidity, Len, which is exactly what was kind of the definition of the Great Depression. Is that what you're saying?
Right. So in other words, at some point in the future, whether it's tomorrow or a year from now, many governments around the world are going to recognize that the biggest mistake they can make is take our credit because it's no good, which will make, you know, our interest rates obviously pop, but it will also decouple us from the rest of the world, which can pretty well do much better without us. And could you comment on that thought?
Well, actually, the world really can't do well without us because we import so much from them. We're all interdependent, but this credit crisis that you mentioned is all over the world, and since the whole world, all over the world, productivity is rising faster than wages, there is a demand problem around the globe, and the whole world is therefore dependent on debt, and once the engines of debt start falling, the entire world slows down, and that's what's happening now.
Yeah.
The world is slowing down. The growth is slowing down all over the world.
Yeah, yeah. And this is something I remember back years ago when you wrote Greenspan's Fraud, which I still think is one of the finest books that's been written in the last 20 years by anybody. And you were identifying this way, way in advance.
Oh, yeah, way in advance, and people were laughing at me. Greenspan's fraud? Greenspan, our hero?
Yeah. I mean, this is how you and I first met. I made this my Buzzflash Book of the Month, I think, 3 or 4 years ago.
That's right.
And, you know, said, you have to read this book if you want to understand how economics works in the United States and how infiltrated with politics it is. Matt in Downey, California. We've got a minute before the break here, Matt. Quick one.
Hi. You know, earlier this week, Tom, you said something about how we needed to get the oil companies into the solar industry. But when I look at it, their incentive is to shut these things down or to minimize the investment because it takes away from the sale of oil and the demand that's driving their prices up. You look at the solar energy website, there's been 8 attempts to have an extension of the solar energy credit, and 8 times it's been stopped with filibusters.
Right, by the Republicans.
Yeah. There was a New York Times article about it Wednesday. And you look, I'm trying to bring this list up and it's not coming up, but they have a list of projects affected. And you look through these projects, there's none of them were big oil companies.
Right.
They're creating a million, you know, there's 116,000 jobs at stake from this legislation because all these projects are on hold. And
let's get Dr. Batra's take on that when we come back from the break. Thanks a lot, Matt, for the call. Ravi Batra is with us, the professor of economics from Southern Methodist University. His website, ravibatra.com. His books, Greenspan's Fraud, The New Golden Age, and many others. Stick around.
The Tom Hartman Program. Visit us on the web at hartmanradio.com.
Comes the rest of our lives.
Fighting for the common person and the common good. The Tom Hartman radio program, 9.5 minutes before the hour. Dr. Ravi Batra with us. Ravi, you want to take a shot at that last question that just
yeah,
before
I think
the break?
Solar energy is the way to go. That has a great future, mainly because the production cost is coming down fast. I mean, California and some other states are now building huge solar energy projects.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in New Mexico, too.
And the reason is the production cost is coming down. Germany is very strong on this. So I think, but oil companies are afraid of this because that's what they're afraid of. The production cost is coming down, and they're afraid of their monopoly.
Yep. 866-303-2270, our number. Steve in Silverton, Oregon. You're on with Dr. Ravi Batra.
Yeah, I have just gotten some information from the Gold Antitrust Association about the U.S. Mint suspending sales of American Gold Eagle coins to dealers and I wonder if you all have any opinion about that or any knowledge.
Hmm. I didn't know about that.
I don't know about it either. So.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Steve. Jeff in Hillsborough. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
A couple of weeks ago, there was a virtually unreported story about collapse of trade talks with the WTO. There were seven nations, only China and India were named, and I'm wondering if you know who was involved and what happened and what does it mean?
This was the collapse of the, was it the Doha round? This is the most recent round that was supposed to be anti-poverty, but was really all about protecting agricultural producers in the United States, I think, most of the poor countries thought, Dr. Batra?
Yeah, the talks broke down, but I think it's good, actually. The more trade deals we have, the more our wages go down.
Yeah.
Whatever the fine lines, we don't know. Whatever they say in the open is very different from the result. So I'm happy that the talks broke down.
Yeah. Deborah in Albany, you're on with Dr. Ravi Batra.
Good morning. I've been increasingly concerned about the dismantling of Glass-Steagall banking regulations, Bernanke's move, which I think is a change to give billions to an investment bank, and the voracious death throes of our banking system. And I learned through your program that the Fed is not a government agency, but a bank-owned entity. So my question, even though they're giving out billions of taxpayer money, my questions are these. Are other quote-unquote central banks government entities, and can the Fed be nationalized so that it's not the banks giving our money to themselves?
Right. Excellent question, Deborah. Dr. Batra, Canada nationalized their Fed for about a two-year period, as I recall, and then it got reprivatized. Ours is a federally chartered corporation, but it's not nationalized. There's a big movement now. In fact, the Green Party is probably going to make this a plank in their platform to nationalize the Fed, buy the stock back from the private owners of that stock, and for the Fed, the 12 Fed banks, and the Fed itself, thus, and have it run by the Treasury Department, which would have been more kind of Jefferson's idea than Hamilton's, I'm guessing. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think they should buy back the stock from foreign, mostly foreign banks own the Fed stock. Did you know that?
No, I didn't. I know that when Andrew Jackson became president in the 1820s or 1830s, whatever year it was, he ran on the campaign of not renewing the charter of the first U.S. bank, and the reason why was because 33% of the bank at that time, the stock was owned by foreigners.
Now, I think more than half is owned by foreigners. Uh-huh. I think it's a good idea to buy back that stock so we have more control over our money supply. But better than
so, Bernanke's employers are more than half of Bernanke's employers, essentially, are not U.S. citizens.
That's right, but we should not make it a part of the Treasury Department because then politics would color its policies.
Mm.
The Fed should stay independent, but I
make it a cabinet level, independent cabinet level agency.
If it can stay independent at the cabinet level, that's okay. But I doubt that's not.
Yeah.
Even the way our special Republicans run the government.
So you just leave it exactly the way it is, except that the major stockholder be the United States of America rather than a bunch of rich families in Europe.
That's right.
Or in Saudi Arabia or in China or
right,
whoever's.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, fascinating. Okay, let's see here. Mary in Los Angeles, thanks for waiting so long.
McCain keeps talking about this nuclear power like it's the greatest thing. Is there an actual number, how much money it would cost to subsidize? It would be great to use this whenever people say that Obama's going to raise taxes. How much are the subsidies going to cost for these nuclear power plants that probably nobody will want to put up?
All right. Not to mention Price Anderson. You know, how do you monetize that? We're talking, by the way, Dr. Ravi Batra. RaviBatra.com, his website. His most recent books, Greenspan's Fraud and the New Golden Age. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, nuclear power, many countries are using it, especially France and Japan. The one problem is it's nuclear waste. And how do nobody has been able to figure that problem out. Where do you store it? And I think solar energy is better because, and also because the cost of production is coming down fast.
Right.
And the sun has unlimited energy.
Here's a great metaphor for that. If the pharaohs 3,000 years ago in Egypt had built nuclear power plants inside the pyramids, they would have gotten 30 years of cheap electricity. And today, 3,000 years later, we would be only about 10% of the way into the total number of years necessary to guard those pyramids to keep people from going near them and getting irradiated.
Yeah, that's my big concern about nuclear power. Radiation is one problem. Then how do you store that nuclear waste? Now, if the technology develops and you can solve these problems, that's a different matter.
Right.
Right now, there isn't any good technology.
No, it's definitely not there. So,
yeah.
And thus all the greater the mess.
And then the alternatives are pretty good: windmill, solar power. They're very good.
Yeah, geothermal. I mean, you know, Iceland is almost entirely geothermal now. They're completely off foreign oil, and they're doing very well. Dr. Ravi Batra, ravibatra.com, his website. Go check it out and buy these two books. These are brilliant. Brilliant introductions to economics written that any person can understand. Greenspan's Fraud and the New Golden Age by Dr. Ravi Batra. Thank you, Dr. Batra. 57 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Is the Tom Hartman Program.
Boy, have I got a story for you. After the next break, I will share with you the information about where Karl Rove was on his vacation and how it might tie into the current conflict in the Crimea, or in the Caucasus. We'll get back to that in just a minute. But right now, Dorothy Fadiman and Ian Sancho are with us. Ian is the supervisor of elections for Leon County, Florida. Dorothy is a filmmaker. They're in and have produced a new movie. The film is Stealing America, Vote by Vote. It's already playing in New York. It's opening today in Los Angeles. And Dorothy and Ian, welcome to the show.
We're glad to be here. Thanks.
Thank you. And welcome to you too, Ian.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Dorothy, first of all, you're the filmmaker here.
Yes.
Okay. tell me about Stealing America. The website is stealingamericathemovie.org, and the movie, of course, Stealing America, Vote by Vote. And by the way, great website, stealingamericathemovie.org. A great trailer there, very thought provoking. Give us a quick thumbnail of this movie.
Well, I was working at the polls in Florida for the 2004 election, and when we were being oriented, the attorney said, "Now I want you to know that people are reporting," and I put that in quotes, "that when they try to vote for Kerry, they're getting Bush on the screen." And he said, "Don't tell anybody that because we don't want to discourage them from voting."
Now, who said this to you?
The attorney that was orienting the volunteers.
So, an attorney for whom?
The attorney representing the Kerry campaign. But we were simply poll observers.
Right. Oh, my goodness.
And well, but that says it all. I mean, you've got the whole picture there. You've got this. You've got the machines, which were behaving strangely. You've got the trend, which is more than 90% of those vote flips across the country in 13 states were going in one direction. And you've got the attorney representing the Democrats saying, don't tell people. So that was the beginning. I mean, I can go on, but basically that was the spark that set me off. I thought, boy, this is a story worth telling. And then when I uncovered what was under that rock, it was huge. And what the film is an overview of the spectrum of things that don't make sense, that weren't reported by the paper, and that really are disenfranchising voters across the country.
Right. And the movie, by the way, opening today at the West Park 8 in Irvine, California, at LeMay's Music Hall 3 on Wilshire Boulevard in Beverly Hills in Los Angeles, and also in Denver, Colorado. We're on the air in Denver at the Chez Artiste 3 on Amherst Avenue. Ian Sancho, you are the, or were, tell me, are or were the supervisor of elections for Leon County, Florida?
I still am, Tom. I've been that for 20 years.
Okay. Did you, you know, talk to us about this story of people trying to vote for Kerry and the machine saying Bush, and what are the things that, what are the irregularities that you saw?
Well, I use an optical scan ballot system in Leon County.
Mm-hmm.
But we heard reports from South Florida all day in 2004 that, in fact, the machines were deselecting the picks by the voters and selecting other candidates. One reporter who I know for one of the major newspapers down there had this happen to him. Mm-hmm. But surprisingly, it was not picked up by any of the major media.
Now, the Speaker of the House, Tom Feeney, was the speaker of the House in the election of 2000 in Florida, the Florida State Legislature.
Yes.
And he made the point that even if under the Constitution, the state can determine how they send electors to Washington, D.C. It doesn't have to be the way the people voted because of the Electoral College. And that the state legislature under the Constitution of Florida has the right to pick the electors. And that even if Al Gore got the majority of votes in Florida, he would send electors to Washington, D.C. on behalf of George W. Bush. It was a done deal. Clint Curtis was working at a computer programming company and has testified under oath and before Congress and is running again against Tom Feeney. Feeney is now in the U.S. House of Representatives. That Tom Feeney came to him and asked him to write a patch, a virus or whatever, that could be used to infect these voting machines to cause votes to flip exactly the way that we're describing them. Do you have any knowledge of that, Mr. Sancho?
Well, I talked to Mr. Curtis about this extensively. I got a chance to meet him over the course of looking at problems in voting in Florida. And it's just another example of the highly partisan nature of the elections process in Florida, and it's controlled by partisans.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Catherine Harris in 2000 was the chairman to reelect George Bush. She also was the Secretary of State. And all through the 2000 election, state officials whose number one priority was to count voters' vote actually did no such thing. At every stage of the operation, such as Catherine Harris not allowing Palm Beach the additional 5 hours to submit completed totals to the state, or actually facilitating by sending an attorney to Palm Beach to essentially bind the canvassing board of Palm Beach so that it wouldn't count Dimple Chads. Essentially, what I saw in the 2000 election were partisan officials who were sworn to uphold the law, instead making sure that their candidate won. And this permeates, unfortunately, the American electoral landscape, whether it's Catherine Harris in 2000 or, as Dorothy has shown very skillfully in her shots, of Kenneth Blackwell in Ohio.
Right.
Another partisan who is, in fact, trying to skew the election. This is something that has to stop. And Dorothy's film points out what happens when you have ideologues in charge of the process.
So Dorothy Fadiman, who is the filmmaker here, we're talking with Dorothy Fadiman and Ian Sancho. Ian is the supervisor of elections for Leon County. Dorothy is the filmmaker of Stealing America, the website stealingamericathemovie.org, themovie.org. Dorothy, to what extent are our, you know, Thomas Paine said the vote is the franchise by which all other franchises are exercised. To deprive a man of his vote is to reduce him to tyranny, or to being the subject of tyranny. I'm quoting it from memory, but I'm pretty sure it's word for word. And to what extent are our votes no longer being in the hands of and being counted by in a transparent fashion government, but rather in the hands of private corporations? And what does this mean for the 2008 elections?
Well, what it means is we've got a couple of months for people to wake up. What we've found throughout the country is when people take a position and start observing at the polls and start actually asking for paper and become aware of all the ways in which this disenfranchisement is permeating the country, there's a shift. And so when we made the film, we set up the long lines and the machine problems and the exit polls, and we really set up a wide spectrum of problems. And toward the end of the film, we go to a state, in this case New Mexico, but there are others, at least 11 states now, in which one citizen said, you know, we have to have paper here. The machines really are subjugating us to this system, and we're absolutely having election results that don't match how we voted. And you watch her reach out to other people across the state, and she speaks of, and we hear about going to the legislature, and then we see New Mexico move toward and get paper, and now they're working toward hand counting those paper ballots. And so what the film really is about is not only is this infection spread nationwide, but that there's also a movement across the country for people to say, we've got to take this back.
Yeah, and we very much have to. We have a little less than a minute. Ian Sancho, Supervisor of Elections for Leon County, your advice on how individuals should interact with their local electoral boards. I mean, shouldn't we be volunteering to be poll watchers or to work with the local election authorities and help us become part of the system?
Absolutely, Tom. Resources are sadly lacking in this area, and whether it's intentional or simply negligence, there are not enough people that are coming forward to work polls. The United States Assistance Commission says we need 2 million more citizens to step forward and get paid to ensure that their fellow Americans can vote.
How do I do that?
You can simply call your elections registrar and ask them, when are you doing the training?
And where do we find the elections registrar in the phone book?
You can just look for voter registration.
Voter registration for your county or
for your county? Most
your county.
Of it's done on
county government offices. Ian Sancho, Dorothy Fadiman, the website StealingAmericaTheMovie.org. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
16 minutes past the hour.
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman Program at HartmanRadio.com.
Minutes past the hour on the True People's Radio, the Tom Hartman Program.
A chicken farmer went out one cold and windy night.
It's our pigeon alert.
He had a bad feeling something wasn't right. Suddenly a giant chicken hit him right in the eye. It was the sight he dreaded. Ghost chickens in the sky.
Well, close enough. Xiao Tong Wing is all alone in life at 57. This by Kerry Seed, by the way, special to the Oregonian. He's all alone in life, never married, never had children, never worked. He lives in a tiny Beijing apartment. Says he doesn't see his family much. His only company is the flock of more than 100 homing pigeons he keeps on his roof. He checks on the new chicks. He's registered with the government as disabled. He receives $58 in welfare each month, but he says the pigeons pay for themselves. Over 1 million pigeons in Beijing. Now we know where these robots are manufactured. It's China! That's the home of the conspiracy. It's gotta be.
Extra crispy and ate them with coleslaw.
Yes, our ghost chicken alert. Okay, here's as promised. Karen Hedwig Backman, a shout-out to Karen, a blogger over at the Daily Kos, who pulled together 2 plus 2 plus 2. This is just absolutely extraordinary. First off, starts out with the news release from August 8th. Dateline Moscow, Georgian troops launched a massive assault on the breakaway province of South Ossetia on Friday, taking control of much of the region and bringing Georgia's U.S. allied government closer to the brink of full-scale conflict with Russia, just hours after Georgian President Mikhail Saakashvili declared a ceasefire with South Odessa's separatist troops. Georgian military forces unleashed a barrage of shelling on the province's capital, Shinkin Valley, late Thursday and early Friday. By the morning, Georgian tanks had entered the South Ossetian capital. So this is what started this whole thing, the invasion of this region of South Ossetia, the capital city of it, by Mikhail Saakashvili. So then Karen Hedwig Bachman asked the question, who did Karl Rove meet with on his sweet vacation in the Crimea? This was July 10th through the 13th when he was supposed to testify before Congress in the Don Siegelman case, and he was out of the country. Well, if you look at the list of participants for the fifth annual Yalta meeting, you find some interesting names. This is the list as printed. Richard Haass. He's the president of the Council on Foreign Relations. Karl Rove, Bob Schrum, and Mikhail Saakashvili. So Karl Rove and Mikhail Saakashvili on the 10th through the 13th of July are sitting together in Yalta. What, hatching schemes? Who knows? In July, and less than 4 weeks later, Saakashvili invades South Ossetia in a way that John McCain believes is going to tremendously help his campaign. Now, you tell me that 2 and 2 does not equal 4. I dare you. Weldon in Minneapolis. Hey, Weldon, thanks for listening online. What's up?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for everything you do. I really like Fridays and the combination Bernie and Batra 2 hour episodes. They're great together.
Thank you.
Just wanted to make a comment that, is this why Rove is just sort of disavowing himself as a campaign manager from McCain so that he can do these underhanded dealings on the side?
In my opinion, entirely, absolutely, 100%. In fact, there is a law that was passed during the John Adams administration in 1799 called the Logan Act. It was named after, as I recall, a congressman, Congressman Logan, who tried to negotiate with the French to reduce tensions. John Adams had whipped up a frenzy in the U.S. over what was called the XYZ affair, where he said that Mr. X, Mr. Y, and Mr. Z in France were trying to bribe a delegation that he sent to France to negotiate with Napoleon. So this the Logan Act makes it a crime for an American to try to act on behalf of the U.S. government or influence U.S. foreign policy or influence another nation's action relative to U.S. foreign policy.
So when McCain sent in Lindsey Graham and Lieberman, wouldn't they also be subject to that same Logan law?
They would be, and I believe if they're going to have to be very, very careful what they say. You could argue that even their presence there is a violation of the Logan Act. The Logan Act, by the way, provides for 3 years in prison plus a fine. And the one caveat is that this is a law which has been on the books since 1799, and nobody has ever been prosecuted under it. It has never been used. But, you know, who knows? Maybe it's time. And maybe it's time now to bring Karl Rove out. And, Weldon, thanks a lot for the call to bring Karl Rove out and say, we're going to have some congressional hearings here, and we're going to move this from the realm of setting up prosecutors, federal prosecutors, in this case specifically Lyra Canary, the wife of Bob Riley, the Republican governor of Alabama's campaign manager, from the federal prosecutor prosecuting Don Siegelman. We're going to go from that to Karl Rove's involvement with Mikhail Saakashvili in Yalta 4 weeks ago. I want to know what the hell is going on here.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Call him now at 866-303-2270. Prison walls still standing tall.
wall. Some things never change at all. Keep on building prisons, gonna fill them all. Keep on building bombs, gonna drop them all. Working your fingers bare to the bone. Breaking your back, make you sell your soul. Like a lung, it's filled with cold. Suffocating slow. The wind blows wild and I may move. But politicians lie and I am not fooled. You don't need no razor nor a three-piece suit to argue the truth.
34 minutes past the hour. Tom Harmon here with you. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Andre in Washington, D.C.
Hey, good afternoon. I'm hoping you could educate me a little bit more about this Georgian situation. I was listening to you, sure, the first hour, and I listened to Bernie, and he mentioned several times that let's not forget that Georgia was the one who, you know, dropped the first bomb or fired the first shot. But I guess my question, and what I hope you can clarify for me, at the end of the day, even if Georgia did that, didn't they do that on their own, in their own country, on their own soil? So for Russia to still say, and I do understand this northern territory, whatever the name of the territory,
South Ossetia,
kind of aligns themselves, their culture, their values, their language with Russia. But when everything is said and done, Georgia kind of, they didn't invade another country. They went and sent their tanks into their own country.
Yeah, it depends on your definition. I mean, this, you're by the United Nations, by NATO, you're absolutely right. The most of them, in fact, all of the major international, who's a country organizations,
sure,
define Ossetia and, or South Ossetia, North Ossetia is part of Russia proper. Define South Ossetia and Abkhazia as part of Georgia. But in 1992, South Ossetia declared their own independence, set up their own capital in Svengali, said that's it, Svengali, excuse me. And Georgia actually signed a treaty, not acknowledging their independence, although they actually in 2006 held a second referendum in the government of South Ossetia, the illegitimate government of South Ossetia, held a second referendum asking their voters if they wanted independence, claimed that their voters said they wanted independence. Again, this was not recognized by us, or by the Georgians.
Okay.
But these have been operating as separate countries since 1992.
So they don't
practical
share
purposes.
The same currency or government and...
No, in fact, Russia has been issuing passports for the people in South Ossetia ever since 1992. Virtually all of the people living in that region who have passports are carrying Russian passports and Russian identity, and they've been more connected with the economy of Russia than with the economy of Georgia.
So why did Georgia invade them in the first place? Are they just trying to bring them back and bring them to make them
yes.
part?
Yeah, there's in fact there was the well here's the hang on just a second I. Someplace I had this story here. Yeah, well, this is the AP story. Just hours after Georgian President Mikhail Saakashvili declared a ceasefire with South Ossetian separatist troops. See, they've been still negotiating this stuff, and there have been these skirmishes that have erupted. Georgian military forces unleashed a barrage of shelling. This is August 8th, Associated Press story. So the question is, why did he go into Svengali, the capital city of South Ossetia, and at midnight? I mean, if you saw Mikhail Gorbachev last night on Larry King Live, his story, and Gorbachev actually has, in my mind, a fair amount of credibility. And he said, you know, it was a little after midnight, and they just came in and they started bombing this town. And then they airlifted troops in and rolled the tanks in, and Georgia invaded essentially South Ossetia, and the Russians while the Olympics are going on, and the Russians at that point said, no, we're not going to allow this to happen. These people are aligned with us, and you're killing people, you know, and the Russians are asserting that over 1,500 people were killed in that night in that bombing. We are asserting, the Western press is asserting that no, it's just it was a few dozen with a few hundred casualties, a few hundred injuries. Pick your choice. You've got dueling stories here.
Excuse my ignorance again, but Gorbachev is still alive. The guy with the birthmark on his ball head.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't realize he was still around.
He was furious. I mean, he went on for like 10 minutes last night on Larry King Live about how this is outrageous. This guy knew that this would provoke a conflict with Russia. He did this at the urging of the West. And so then Larry King gets Mikhail Saakashvili on immediately after he's got Gorbachev on, condemning Saakashvili as being the aggressor and the guy who's trying to provoke an international confrontation for some benefit of some party in the West who's not identified. And Larry King's first question to Saakashvili is, didn't you start this? And Saakashvili never answered the question. He went off on a rant about how Gorbachev used to be considered a good guy and everybody thought that he told the truth, but obviously he doesn't now because he's taking the side of Russia in this, you know, blah, blah, blah. He went off into an ad hominem attack. And I was sitting there with my mouth open as I was watching this on CNN last night. If it replays,
still alive. Oh my goodness.
Yeah, if it replays tonight on CNN, it's really, really worth watching.
I'll take a look. Thanks a lot,
yeah,
buddy.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks a lot, Andre, for the call. Appreciate it. See, this, not particularly when you're talking about, you know, former Soviet republics and stuff, nothing is ever as simple as it seems. It just ain't. Henry in Monticello, Minnesota. Hey, Henry, what's up?
Yeah, hi, Tom. I'm going to try to talk quickly. If I get too fast, slow me down, but I know that your time is limited. I'm a first-time caller, long-time listener, and if you and your listeners really want to know who is responsible for the anthrax mailings, there is a book, or there was a book on the market. It may not be there anymore, but the name of the book, or the title, is Germs, and it was written by Judith Miller, the former bioterrorism scientist at the New York Times.
Right.
And this book was written just before the anthrax attacks through the mail. Mm-hmm. And it's very easy, very simply, you can connect the dots. What happened when the Soviet Union closed down their bioterrorism units department? They took samples of all of their biological terrorism products, and they took the samples and put them in refrigerators, and they closed down the rest of it. Now, what happened when they closed down their bioterrorism units is that we went over and we got their top bioterrorism scientists. And we brought them over here, ultimately, and they're being warehoused in a company called Advanced Biosystems. And they get a lot of federal dollars. I'm not going to go into the minutia.
Yeah. But, well, let me just drop something in here, Henry. Yesterday, it was reported that the hair samples that were associated with the letters that were sent to Senators Daschle and Leahy, the two guys who could have stopped the Patriot Act, who by coincidence were the only two politicians to receive anthrax, just as the Patriot Act was being negotiated or being discussed, that the hair sample associated with that, clearly and definitely, it was announced yesterday, was not a match for Mr. Ivins, the guy who committed suicide, who the government wants us to believe was the guy who sent the letters. Also, their timeline, which would put him at the mailbox where they know these things were mailed from, has fallen apart. They cannot demonstrate that he was there. In fact, there's a fair body of evidence that he was elsewhere. And it looks like this whole story has fallen apart around them.
Well, it's falling apart, Tom, like the Hatfield story has fallen apart.
Yeah.
And they're doing it a little differently this time. I'm not going to go into what I think is happening with Ivins. But it will be obvious if you read the book. I don't know if it's still available in the bookstores. It may have been purged.
I'm looking at Amazon right now, and I'm seeing that they have 520 used and new copies. But they're not. Amazon is not selling it, which means that it's been withdrawn from publication by its publisher, who was Simon & Schuster, the same people who just published the book attacking Barack Obama, the new book by Jerome Corsi.
Well, if it's not available, I have a copy. And,
well, you can buy it used on Amazon.com.
And you can.
And yeah, over 500 people are offering used copies. And I'm sure ABEbooks.com and probably any of your local used bookstores. But, yeah, the title of the book is Germs, Biological Weapons and America's Secret War. And actually three authors, Judith Miller is the lead one, and then Stephen Engelberg and William Broad.
Right.
And that's interesting. I did not know. I knew that she had written this book, you know, kind of vaguely, but I've never actually had a copy in my hands. I'm going to buy one now that you have alerted me to this.
You will know after you read it. You will be able to connect the dots so easily that a trained chipmunk could connect the dots.
Wow.
What we did, Tom, is we went over there, we got their top bioterrorism scientists, and they are much more experts. They have expertise that we couldn't even dream of back
so
then.
Is it your hypothesis, Henry, that that some rogue element put together and sent this anthrax, or do you think that this was something that came out of, for example, the Cheney Rove machine?
You know, Tom,
I'm willing to believe either one, frankly.
Yeah, well,
that's how weird I'm, you know,
If you add into the formula, if you add in the Ivans and the Hatfield situations, you will have no doubt about the answer to that question.
Yeah, okay. Well, you've read the book. I haven't. You know, you want to give me a quick one or two words?
Well, let me just... It's hard to give you a quick. We have their scientists, and we have them warehoused.
Okay, Henry, I'm sorry. We've got to take a break. The clock starts running at 45 minutes past the hour, whether I want it to or not. But I appreciate the call, and I'll check it out. I'm going to buy the book on the break.
This is The Moment. Continuing live coverage from Denver of the Democratic National Convention on Air America and AirAmerica.com. Our time is now.
Thanks so much to Louise Hartman, to my producer, our executive producer, Sean Taylor, to Chris Rosen, Lauren Kirshner, and Marcus Hillman at Air America New York, to Sue Nethercutt, the folks in our chat room, hey, and to Mike Toth. Hey, Mike, thank you so much for doing our audio archives on our website. We just got them updated and all tweaked and looking good. To our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for listening to our program, and also thanks to Victoria Jones and the great folks at the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom. Glad to be with you.
Thank you. It's always great to hear your voice. In fact, I thought I saw you on television yesterday. Last night, I was watching BBC News, and there was it Condi Rice at the CIA? Somebody was at the CIA.
Yes, I was at the CIA. Yes.
Yeah, and you were standing there with your short red hair, and you asked a question and about the president or something, and she turned around and walked away. Do I recall that right?
They took no questions. We tried.
Yeah, it was as I was kind of drifting off to sleep that I saw it happen. But interesting. And I have a question for you. The 10th through the 13th of July in Yalta. There was a meeting. This was when Karl Rove was supposed to testify before Congress, and you recall he was out of the country.
Right.
Well, it turns out he was at the 5th annual Yalta meeting, along with Mikhail Saakashvili, the president of Georgia. They're listed as co-participants at the conference. This was 3 weeks before Saakashvili starts dropping bombs in South Ossetia in an action that the Russian media, Izvestia and Pravda, are specifically and explicitly saying was done to benefit the John McCain campaign.
Wow.
Now, is there going to be any... I mean, all of the things that I've said up to this point are just matters of fact. I mean, it's the 2+2+2. Do you think that there's any possibility that anybody in the corporate media in the United States is going to ask any questions about this?
I think it's highly unlikely. I think that is going to remain completely under the radar in the same way that I think that almost no questions are going to be asked about Senators Lieberman and Graham going in a kind of strange foreign policy move on the McCain campaign, as though he's got his own foreign policy team. No questions are going to be asked about
that. We have this thing called the Logan Act that makes it illegal for anybody to perform or whatever foreign policy actions without specific authorization of the U.S. government. I mean, if these guys are going to get involved in doing foreign policy, they're breaking the law.
Well, I'm sure it will be said that they're not doing that, that they're just observing, you know, that they're not going to do any foreign policy, that they're just going to offer support.
Do you think they're going over observing to tell Saakashvili, hey, thanks a lot, we really appreciate you doing what Karl Rove suggested, and we're going to do everything we can to cover your backside?
That is one way of interpreting it.
Yeah. Here's the Logan Act says, this was passed in 1799, by the way. It's still in the books. Any citizen of the United States, wherever he may be, who without authority of the United States directly or indirectly commences or carries on any correspondence or intercourse with any foreign government or any officer or agent thereof with intent to influence the measures or conduct of any foreign government or of any officer there or agent thereof in relation to any disputes or controversies with the United States or to defeat the measures of the United States shall be fined under this title or imprisoned not more than 3 years or both. So, interesting. Anyhow, what's going on in the world? What's the news?
Well, we've got this peace agreement that Condoleezza Rice agreed to, and that Saakashvili came out and very grim-faced basically blamed the entire thing on the Europeans. And in this peace agreement, she has the agreement for allowing the Russians to implement additional security measures. Now, in the original agreement, they allowed the Russians to implement additional security measures while awaiting an international monitoring mechanism. It was this language that the Russians took to allow themselves to invade Gori and to advance on Tbilisi, because the language is very vague. No one knows what it means. I asked Dana Perino about it yesterday. She said she didn't know what the language meant. That same language is in the new peace agreement.
Well, BBC was pretty explicit last night suggesting that what that language means is that the peacekeeper in that region right now is Russia, and that they can perform peacekeeping operations anywhere within the country of Georgia, from South Ossetia all the way down to Tbilisi. And this could be used by the Russians as an excuse to simply annex Georgia, and which would be why Saakashvili was, you know, when he signed this thing, was looking like a guy who just, you know, somebody just pulled the plug and drained half his oil out.
And he's not a happy man at all.
Yeah. Well, I think he took Karl Rove's advice, and it was, you know, it was greatly to the benefit of John McCain, and he didn't realize he was being used as a pawn.
He may not have realized that, and perhaps he was. Another thing that I think is very interesting is a statement of John McCain that I'm sure you're familiar with, where he said, "My friends, we've reached a crisis, the first probably serious crisis internationally since the end of the Cold War. This is an act of aggression."
Right.
This is a fairly astonishing statement when you consider the other serious crises internationally that we've had since the end of the Cold War,
right,
and a statement that's largely been left alone by the mainstream media.
Right. It's like 9/11 never happened, Afghanistan never happened, Iraq never happened, you know, et cetera, et cetera. I think that what this is the Karl Rove strategy of recalibrating the issue in this election to be the Cold War in Russia, because if the issue in this election is Iraq, Obama wins. If the election is the economy, Obama wins. If it's Russia, you know, Obama hasn't really staked that out as his territory.
Obama is not playing this smart.
Yeah, I agree, and it's going to be very interesting to watch. Victoria Jones, TalkRadioNews.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
Monday, Michelle Bernard, the Independent Women's Forum, is going to be with us, along with Alan Weissman, or at different, at separate times, and, of course, your calls and the news of the day. Don't forget, my friends, activism begins with you. Democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. Get out there, get active. Volunteer to help out with the vote this fall. We'll see you. Have a great weekend. We'll see you Monday.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit HartmannRadio.com.